I get to introduce my very dear friend, Dean Hammer. Dean was one of the original Plowshares 8. He was the youngest member of that group. He somehow knew at a young age that that was an important, that his life was had to be made to telling purpose in this world. And the most telling purpose that he could find at the age of 22 was with Phil Berrigan and Dan Berrigan and other wonderful people doing the Plowshares 8 action. And then he did another one, which landed him in jail when I was in jail for doing another one. And Dean was very early on knew he wanted to be a psychologist, and he very early on had strong spiritual inclinations, which took him to Yale Divinity School, where he became where he took a master's degree in divinity. And now Dean is a clinical psychologist at the doctoral level at Antioch University, who's very, very concerned about these wars we find ourselves in, the mental health aspects or the mental disease aspects of war. Maybe we can get some ideas on how we can heal ourselves. Dean.
So friends, it's a great privilege to be here tonight, to be part of this committee to form a peace commission that wants to abolish war. Now, the framework for my reflections this evening are constructed from Dr. Martin Luther King's speech delivered at Riverside Church in April 1967. April 4th, 1967, a year to date before his assassination. I thought as I was preparing that maybe I should just step aside and we should get a YouTube or a DVD of that speech, and I could sit down and then we could see the speech and talk, and that would be fine, probably better than what I'll do tonight. So I encourage you to at least read the speech, if not hear the speech, because it's life-changing. And also, I will be referring to the work of Eric Fromm, an old psychologist, a neo-Freudian, who wrote this book called The Sane Society that many of you have probably read along the way. Dr. King's speech was entitled Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. Thus, my title tonight is Beyond War, A Time for Revolutionary Hope. This vintage oratory occurred during a time of awful bloodletting, much like our current times. In his wonderful cadence, Dr. King exhorted the audience by stating, "A time comes when silence is betrayal." And he continued, "A new spirit is rising among us. These are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men and women are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. And out of the wounds of a frail world, new systems of justice and equality are being born." Oh, yeah. "We in the West must support these revolutions. So from the streets of Tunisia, Egypt, Bahrain, Libya, Yemen, etc., we can hear the drumbeat of revolution moving to Madison, Wisconsin. We have our work cut out for us to understand the signs of the times and to join this dramatic movement of liberation and justice making." Dr. King marked his steps from the Birmingham jail to the Great Hall at Riverside Church. And similarly, as Jim was referring to, I want to mark my steps from Danbury Prison to this town hall in Leverett. While a student at Yale Divinity School in the 70s, I had a great fortune of meeting Daniel and Philip Berrigan, two radical peace activists. These notorious troublemakers became my mentors and called me onto the pathway from Yale to jail. That's Dave Dellinger saying, not mine. Glad to follow his way. In September 1980, I joined Daniel and Philip and five other friends in a peace witness that came to be known as the Plowshares 8. We entered a plant owned by General Electric in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, where component parts of nuclear weapons were being built. With household hammers, we disarmed the nose cones that were being designed for the Mark 12A intercontinental ballistic missile, beginning a series of 90 plowshares actions in the United States, Europe, and Australia during the past 30 years. The action was dubbed a break-in by the press, but I would prefer to call it a waltz-in. We entered in there with hammers under our jackets so no one would be alarmed. Two of our friends engaged the security person and did a little dance, and then the other people, the six of us, went around, and we made our way into the non-destructible testing area, where we uncovered the nose cones, enacted the disarmament for about 15 minutes or so, and then stood around and prayed. We also poured human blood on the blueprints, trying to say that this preparation for war is a bloody mess. The workers began to come into the area, and they were quite white-faced. It was as though that they had walked into a dreamscape. And we just continued to pray and thank God for being able to initiate the first act of disarming nuclear weapons that had occurred in history. Not because we were paragons of virtue, because we were just trying to do the right thing. After participating in a second Plowshares action in Thanksgiving of 1983 at Rome Air Force Base, where they were backfitting B-52 bombers to carry cruise missiles, I was sentenced to 3 years in federal prison. It was at that time at Danbury where I met Jim, and as he said, we studied the scriptures, we became good friends, and we took out the trash together for 14 months. So I was thinking of the chapter from Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Pieces Every Step, about composting our emotions. So out of the compost of taking out the trash at Danbury Prison, we come here tonight to be with you. Compost is a very good thing. Little did we know that over 25 years later, here we would be, still singing out this song, No More War, Abolish War Now. After my federally sponsored internship, I began working as a mental health clinician, which has been part of my vocational journey for the past 25 years. My doctoral studies at Antioch University included a rather intense search to integrate my commitment to peace activism and my developing role as a clinical psychologist. I have been searching for a psychotherapy office large enough that we could put society into it and engage in societal psychotherapy, right? Unfortunately, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the Bible in the field of psychiatry, is exclusively focused on individual psychopathology trouble. One of the queries that I present to you this evening is whether we need to create a diagnostic procedure and a therapeutic process to attend to societal psychopathology. Yes. I'm not the first to think of this idea, for sure. So in his book, The Sane Society, Eric Fromm poses the question, can individuals maintain sanity in an insane society? No. The question highlights the need to create systemic societal change for the sake of our sanity. If the ecological setting of our lives is contaminated, then we have to address this dimension of pathology in order to foster individual and collective well-being. So tonight, I invite you into an experience of dreaming into the possibility of a world without war. In addition to the left brain task of outlining some of the dimensions or criteria of the pathology of war making, I want to invite you into this integral bright right brain function of imagining a foreseeable future in which the human family has overcome this obsolete process of resolving conflict through killing our enemies. Obsolete, outdated like a dinosaur. However, as Robert J. Lifton has taught us, and he's a very special mentor to many of us, our individual and collective imaginations have been severely wounded by living in a world threatened by annihilation. One of the casualties of living in our world is our imagination, our ability to dream. We must enter into a process of healing the trauma of being participants and bystanders of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, My Lai, and the killing fields of Iraq and Afghanistan, to mention just a few of the tragic events in which our government and military personnel commit awful crimes against civilian populations. Surely the experience of 9/11 in September of 2001 has created serious unhealed psycho-spiritual wounds in the landscape of the American people. Furthermore, the United States and other superpowers who possess nuclear and other weapons of mass destruction hold the human family hostage to the terror of omnicide. People familiar with this term? The destruction of all life as we know it. So in the ER, I would try to assess suicidal and homicidal behavior. Today, we live in a global ER where homicide and suicide have turned into omnicide. Yikes. What do we do with that? In order to engage in the process of developing revolutionary hope that will enable us to overcome the pathology of war, we need to overcome our fears, our prejudices, our unhealed wounds, and our cynicism. Hope, then, is a curative factor in my work as a psychotherapist. And I suggest this evening that revolutionary hope is an essential component to building a liberation movement to abolish war. Revolutionary hope, not just ordinary hope. And this is not false optimism. So to move into some of the left brain analysis, to delineate the pathology of war. I've just come up with an overview or a snapshot, which could really be at least a semester-long course, if not a four-year peace psychology degree. So this will only be a small slice of the pie, a beginning that perhaps could grow amongst us in study groups and conversations along the way. Please imagine that this town hall has become the consultation room for the assessment of societal psychopathology. In 1989, Roger Walsh, a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, Irvine, wrote a seminal paper entitled toward a psychology of human survival. Psychological approaches to contemporary global threats. He delineated some of the global threats which continue to plague us today. Malnutrition, resource depletion, the blight against the ecology, and nuclear weapons. These threats to human survival and well-being, he suggests, and I concur, are actually symptoms of our individual and collective mindsets. Walsh employs a cognitive and an evolutionary approach in formulating his assessment of societal psychopathology. From a cognitive psychology framework, here the psycholanguage comes, maladaptive core belief systems contribute to dysfunctional behaviors. Maladaptive core assumptions about the nature of the self, your relationship to others, your view of the world, and your view of the future, your core assumptive world, will then inform how one acts in the world. And if those core assumptions or core beliefs are maladaptive or skewed, then the behavior will also be skewed. So I will be suggesting that fatalism and social Darwinism create a self-fulfilling prophecy that perpetuates war. Two types of maladaptive core belief systems. Also, from a developmental perspective, a person needs to progress through various stages of psychosocial growth in order to evolve into stages of adult maturity. The developmental arrest at the collective level has contributed to war-making pathology manifested by perpetual adolescent bullying and addictive behavior. I'll take the groans to be affirmation. And finally, a lens adapted from Fromm will serve to identify the ways that technology and prejudice create a dehumanization of the enemy, which then enables nation states to legitimize their homicidal and genocidal behaviors. The pathological orientation also feeds the escalating spending on weapons and troops at the expense of human services, as well as perpetuating the egregious neglect of the veterans returning home from war, with remarkably high levels of PTSD and suicide. Would you believe the Pentagon wanted to spend $17 million to study the suicide rate of returning vets? They needed a study. I want to say, give me a break. You need to spend the $17 million caring for the vets, diagnosing the PTSD, which they refuse to do because they don't want to offer the treatment. Therefore, we are faced with the necessity of creating interventions to create systemic change in order to eradicate the pathology of war. So first, fatalism. During my 35 years of peace activism, I've engaged in many conversations regarding the possibility of abolishing war. One of the most prevailing attitudes that deter people from the capacity to imagine a world without war is the assumption that there always have been wars and there always will be wars. How many of you ever heard that argument? Too often. This maladaptive core belief is built upon a pessimistic view of human nature that sees human beings as essentially greedy and self-serving. From this cognitive perspective, the maladaptive core schema rejects the capacity of human beings to become altruistic and to commit ourselves to the well-being of the entire human family as a prerequisite for the individual's well-being. Altruism is essential to our individual well-being. However, the superpower nations depend on the military-industrial complex as the backbone for their economies, depend on this cynical view of human nature. Therefore, an initial step in developing a revolutionary hope for the future is to embrace this new vision that portrays humankind as having the capacity to create global peace and justice and to act altruistically. This has to be part of the revolution. So we have to, day by day, be acting on behalf of the neighbor. Those we live with, those in our neighborhoods, those who are suffering needlessly. So much more to say about that. Secondly, social Darwinism. Charles Darwin, the 19th century British scientist, developed a theory of biological evolution which has strongly impacted Western psychology and political philosophy. He posited that through the process of natural selection, the organisms that are best adapted to their environment tend to survive, while those less adapted tend to be eliminated. As we consider the animal kingdom, those with the greatest strength are able to dominate those with lesser strength. In other words, the strongest survive. As we consider the human species and the progression of war making, the groups, tribes, and nations that survive are those who have the bigger or more powerful weapons. In other words, you know the little saying, where does an 800-pound gorilla walk? Wherever he damn well pleases. Excuse my French. This then becomes a lived-out caricature of the nation-state, who possesses the most potent arsenals. Those can then amass also the largest troops and dominate the world, strutting around like an 800-pound gorilla. However, in the case of nuclear weapons arsenals, the superpowers are also strutting around what I would call a delusional belief system that they can responsibly manage the risk factors of using nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. We can tell Iran they can't have nukes, but we can. What's up with that? So one of the future areas of research is to declare weapons of mass destruction a delusional disorder. As we analyze the reality of the effects of using nuclear weapons, the evidence strongly indicates that there will be no winners in a nuclear war, and in fact, the survivors will envy the dead. If you've seen the movies about nuclear winter, it's frightful. Our special friend Tom Lewis, who has since passed over, had this expression of a daymare. People know what a daymare is? It's a nightmare while we're awake. So nuclear winter would be a daymare, a living nightmare. And we spend billions and billions of dollars to prepare for a daymare. Delusional, at least. Unfortunately, from my perspective, since the height of resistance to nuclear weapons during the 1980s, Many people no longer believe that we live under the threat of nuclear war. A significant portion of the population appears to be lulled into the false and lethal belief system that our government can be trusted to build and deploy nuclear weapons in a safe way. This is what I would call legalized insanity, just like the concentration camps of Nazi Germany. In Nazi Germany, the concentration camps were legal. In the United States of America, the Trident submarine is legal. One Trident, and this was when it was first built, carries 24 missiles. Each missile has 17 multiple warheads. They're MIRVed, right? So one sub targets 408 cities, each city being 100,000 people or more. One Trident can potentially kill 40,800,000 people. And anybody know how many Tridents are out in the waters? 18. And this is just one part of the sea-based leg of the triad, sea, air, land-based nuclear weapons. 5,113 warheads currently in the arsenal at my last look. The United States alone can destroy the world at least 10 or 15 times over. A daymare. Social Darwinism, the strong survive, or we promote a revolution, or what one article in Common Dream said, a new moral intelligence is breaking out. No more nuclear weapons, no more war. Thirdly, socio-political immaturity. One of the major contributions of the psychologist Erik Erikson was his epigenetic model of psychosocial identity development. In his book, Insight and Responsibility, Erikson makes the case that these stages of development can also be applied to cycles of generations and societal development. Therefore, I want to hypothesize that our society and other nation states manifest a developmental arrest in their socio-political maturation process. The maladaptations are manifested by bullying behavior by the United States and other nation states who strut around like the 800-pound gorilla I was referring to. Now, bullying behavior has become a major issue in the schools of our country, a hot topic for psychologists. I want to suggest that the students of our elementary schools and junior high schools and high schools are learning their behavior from our government. It's what Ann Wilson Chafe calls a hologram. The micro scale mirrors the macro scale. If the United States can go into countries like Iraq and Afghanistan and act like a bully, why shouldn't the children in the schools do the same? Erikson defines the negative outcome of developmental arrest as a kind of malignancy. And at one stage, he talks about one of the maladaptations as fanaticism, which by some has been understood as doubling one's efforts while losing sight of one's goals. A great definition of fanaticism. Thus, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been waged supposedly in order to overcome terrorism. And yet the United States, in conjunction with other NATO allies, have terrorized the civilian populations of these countries. Perhaps some of you have read the news accounts of some American troops bringing back fingers as trophies of their war-fighting feats. Yuck. If we are to mount a revolution of hope, we must attend to the gang warfare mentality of the nation state, who act like hoods, intimidating and killing anyone who challenges their rule over certain territories. Just like in the streets of LA, Chicago, Philadelphia, New York City, gang warfare. How different are the nation states from these gangs? A revolution of values will depend upon a psychological, political, and spiritual maturation process that overturns the domination of hoodlum nation states. In 1957, Albert Camus wrote this great essay called The Wager of Our Generation. And I offer you this quote from that essay. Europe has not yet emerged from 50 years of nihilism or the belief of no meaning in life. But the most people... But the moment people begin rejecting the mystification on which nihilism is based, then hope is possible. We have to reject the spirituality of darkness perpetuated by the nation state. The whole question is to know whether or not we, human beings, shall develop faster than the rocket with a nuclear warhead. And unfortunately, the fruits of the spirit are slower to ripen than intercontinental missiles. But after all, since atomic war would divert any future of its meaning, it gives us complete freedom of action. We have nothing to lose except everything. So let's go ahead. This is the wager of our generation. If we are to fail, it is better in any case to have stood on the side of those who choose life than on the side of those who are destroying. We have nothing to lose except everything. Fourthly, the addictive process of warfare, war-making behavior. Ann Wilson Chafe, in her book, When Society Becomes an Addict, identify some of the characteristics of addictive systems, including self-centeredness, dishonesty, and greed. It is no secret that the United States is governed by a war economy. The military-industrial complex maintains untold privileges in our fiscal process. At a time of budget cuts, social services get axed, and the Pentagon budget escalates. The cost of wars during the last decade alone tally beyond $3 trillion. Can anybody count to $3 trillion? It takes a long time. $3 trillion in the last 10 years, and that's a modest estimate, and it's climbing daily. The nature of addiction is that there is never enough. For drug addicts, there is never enough drugs. And for our war addiction, there is never enough weapons or potential enemies. If we don't have an enemy, we'll find one so that the war economy will go forward. How are we doing in this consultation room for society so far? How do we keep our spirits up? How do we deal with our counter transference to the client? In my work with psychotherapy clients, I also use a book called The 12 Steps for Everyone. The assumption of this book is that we all have some type of addictive process from which we are recovering. In this way, our society needs to practice as a collective the 12 steps in order to heal our collective addiction to war and weapons of war. In the first step, We need to admit that we are powerless over our collective obsession with war making and that it makes our lives unmanageable. Certainly, the money spent on war is a theft from the poor, and its effects contaminate the environment, ruin the lives of countless veterans and their families, and the civilian populations that we kill. In the second step, we state that we've come to believe in a power greater than us that can restore us to sanity. Now, this evening, I've not come to evangelize you to believe in God. That might be a good conversation to have, but not tonight. I do want to strongly encourage you to appreciate the higher power inherent in this type of town gathering. To create a peace commission that is devoted to abolishing war. For me, that is a higher power, greater than any one of us, that can help restore our lives to sanity. If and when this peace commission is gathered, then we can begin to gather and organize towns all around the country to do the same. And let's say amen to that.
Amen.
And lastly, the dehumanization process of war and the anonymity of group process. The fifth criteria of war-making pathology. And then I'll back off of this left brain process. Given the technological advances regarding weapons of war and the nature of war fighting behavior, it has all become sterilized and dehumanized. The drones have been inserted, and I use that word intentionally, inserted into the battlefield of Afghanistan, and now we witness video war live. There are no human fighter pilots, but rather the execution of this type of combat is done in the safety of the command headquarters. The enemy and the blood spilled is no longer experienced by those who participate in this type of fighting. On a psychological level, the enemy is reduced to a subhuman creature that needs to be exterminated in order to ensure the health and well-being of our country. This has echoes of the concentration camps of Nazi Germany, when the Jews and other minorities were considered to be vermin that needed to be exterminated. Therefore, the killing of civilian populations is spoken euphemistically in terms of collateral damage. Just this last week, 65 Afghan civilians died in a NATO raid. Most of them children. And just a few days ago, 9 boys were killed in Afghanistan as they were gathering firewood for their families. And we say, oops, we're sorry, and we continue to do it. This has become a common occurrence since the war in Iraq began in March 2003. There are various estimates of civilian deaths in the Iraq war ranging from 100,000 to 600,000 to well over 1 million civilian deaths. This type of mass killing of innocent civilians is surely insane and unacceptable. Warfare pathology at its worst. The Geneva Convention no longer protects civilian populations. One of the challenges is that we continue to suffer the Kitty Genovese syndrome. The syndrome is derived from an event in New York City in the 90s when a woman was murdered while over 30 people watched this. No one intervened. We come together tonight to take responsibility for the insanity of war. We must say together that the government is no longer permitted to build and deploy weapons of mass destruction in our name. They are no longer allowed to kill innocent civilians in our name and by using our tax money. No more. So in conclusion, Fromm in his book, The Sane Society, presents an analysis of dehumanization fostered by capitalistic society devoted to never-ending technological advancement at the expense of the environment and human well-being. Unhealthy society, he suggests, is one that creates mutual hostility, distrust, and transforms people into instruments of exploitation. This sounds all too familiar. Conversely, Fromm describes a healthy society as one which fosters the human capacity to love and to serve the needs of one another. Not very fancy, but very apt. Fromm contends that nationalism is an idolatry and patriotism is a cult. We need to engage in a process of collective healing in order to reclaim our sanity and our chance to survive as a species. To build a healthy and a sane society, to shrug off the idolatry of nationalism and the cult of patriotism. One of my special teachers, Henry Nouwen, tells the following story in his book, Clowning in Rome. A young boy comes upon a sculptor in the streets. The sculptor is working in a studio in Rome. The boy watches with great fascination as the sculptor chisels away at the stone, and slowly but surely, a lion emerges out of the stone. And the boy asks the sculptor, "How did you know there was a lion in the stone?" The sculptor wouldn't answer immediately, sends the boy home, and the boy comes back, and the sculptor eventually answers, "The lion in my heart saw the lion in the stone." So too, we need to adopt the perspective of a sculptor as we encounter the shell of our society that appears to be a stone-cold, murderous collective in its war-fighting behavior. We need to cry out that deep in our hearts, we see through the stone that there is a society that we can begin to live out that is loving, altruistic, tender-hearted. A society that refuses to kill our enemies and waste our most precious resources on this obsolete behavior called war. In closing, I want to return to the inspiration of Dr. King. Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. We as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must conquer the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism. A true revolution of values will lay hand on the world order and say of war, "This way of settling differences is not just." My friends, we are now faced with a fierce urgency. These are revolutionary times. We still have a choice today: nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. Nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. So let us choose in this crucial moment in history to live out a revolutionary hope by abolishing war.